Hello, everybody. J.J. Cooper, Carlos Colosso, Baseball America Draft Podcast. We took a week off last week, but we're back. You know, we had a little bit of a rest and recovery time. Well, not really, but we did. We recovered and did other stuff. But yeah. We are back this week, and it's an important week because the 2026 draft is officially in the books now. We had the signing deadline. We're recording this a couple of days before it goes releases, but Monday of this past week that we recorded this, we had the signing deadline. And I'm going to kind of just hand this over to you because you've been doing the crunching the numbers, pulling out the tidbits and all this. But I'll just start with, it was very similar to normal expectations, which is we've been saying it now for really the entirety of the kind of feel like the 2020s now. Obviously, the 2020 draft will be the only draft probably for a very long time where you say everyone signed, but a five-round draft. But we say every year, don't get too caught up on, oh, is this player going to sign or this player going to sign? Just assume they will. Almost without fail, they do. Logan Schmidt, Aiden Nack, only two players in the top 12 rounds who did not sign. Carlos, like, big picture, what did you kind of take away from this? And what are kind of some of the interesting nuggets that you learned from it?
Yeah, big picture. I mean, I will say with that, that signing rate that you mentioned, there were at least some elements this year that could have created some changes there. We talked about some of the reasons for that, the NIL, increased college eligibility, how that would factor out. Nope, it's more of the same. Teams are doing their homework on who they're signing. They are connecting with the players before they make them the pick. Largely, teams know exactly how much money is going to each player before we get close to signing deadline, and getting close to that deadline is just making the deals official. Maybe a few players haggling for a little bit more here and there. Teams deciding how much into their pool they want to go. But this year, teams spent more than $400 million on bonuses on players who were selected in the first 20 rounds. More than that, if you include all the money that is going to the undrafted free agents, which we had a huge other update for that tracker. Once we got the official numbers, like you mentioned, just two players in the top 10, top 12 rounds who didn't sign, but top 10 rounds is the round range we're focused on for not signing players, where that actually comes with some penalties or some limitations for the teams. And then beyond that, I thought it was interesting to see this year, 23 teams spent at least 4% over their pool. So a vast majority of the teams, if you want to look at the draft, almost every single team understands the value that is created here. They maximize their pool. This year, 11 teams spent to the full 5% overage if you're rounding that number to the nearest thousandth. We had one team who spent their exact pool. That was Pittsburgh to the dollar. They spent their exact pool. They didn't go over it. Six teams didn't spend their full pool. And I guess I can mention those specific teams. The Marlins, the Twins, the Mariners, the Cardinals, the Royals, and the D-backs did not hit 100% of their pool. And then maybe the most interesting team in terms of like how are you spending in the draft this year, I think, are the Rockies. This year they spent 4.9% over their pool.
Yay!
That is notable. Yes, celebrate for the Rockies. Very
okay,
clear.
I'm calling you out, Twins. Change. I'm calling you out.
What JJ is talking about now, the Twins are now the only team in the bonus pool era that has never spent north of their pool. And just to reiterate here, if you spend up to 5% over, the only penalty you pay is additional tax on that overage. So it doesn't come with pick penalties. It's essentially, are you willing to spend as much as you can possibly spend on the draft? Almost every team, as you just heard, 23 teams, at least 4% over, do that. Not doing it is essentially giving away value, and the Twins are the only team now that the Rockies have gone over to never go over their pool in the bonus pool era.
So
those are my kind of top level takeaways.
I'm just going to emphasize again, I called this out before. That's like, what I would say about that is like, look, I'm calling out Twins ownership really when I say that, not the Twins. Like the only people, the people who are deciding that are generally the people who are cutting.
Everyone in the draft room would like to spend as much money as they possibly can, to be clear.
And let me be clear. We're not talking about, oh, you're going to get an extra three players out of this or that. That's not what we're talking about. But we are talking about, you've tied one hand slightly behind your back because you are basically saying we are going to unilaterally disarm by 4.9% of our bonus pool, you know, the 4.9% overage compared to other teams. And as you just laid out, Not every team does it every year. That's not what we're talking about. But 29 out of 30 teams have done it now. And again, the only penalty for it is you're not just going to pay. If you go over by 150,000 or by 500,000 or whatever that 4.9% is, then you're going to pay a tax on that on top. That's it. Nothing else. No draft penalties. No, you lose the ability to do this or anything. It is just, nope, we don't spend that. And so I did want to ask one other before we kind of get into the bigger picture stuff. The two who did not sign, I would say let's especially focus on Logan Schmidt, right? Aiden Knack's a little different, a little later round. I know that I've gotten like questions from viewers, BA readers, asking like, so they really screwed up here, right? And I just want to kind of lay out for like that. I just don't follow the logic here, because if you said they lose the pick, I would completely agree with you, right? Like, yes, everyone right. else figured out signing. They didn't. And so, wow, they really screwed up. If this was where, you know, like, well, we just failed to sign our second round pick.
Right.
That would be one thing. But the way that the draft rules work. So I'll lay out a scenario and you kind of tell me how, you know, like there comes a point with players where sometimes you can just say like, the example I will give on this is, hey, the example that really stood out was Jay Groom years ago, where it's like there was a team, you know, we knew that the Padres were trying to float Jay Groom down the board. And then a team, the Red Sox, just said, okay, we're taking him. And they had no idea about signability at that point. But their logic was the talent here is such, we think we'll be able to sign him. And they knew in the back of their head, if we don't, we'll get one pick later next year. So no real significant penalty. I feel like with Schmidt here, yes, they clearly did not establish a number from everything we mm-hmm. understand. There wasn't like there was an agreement and then something fell through or anything like that. They basically right. looked at it and said, on talent, this guy is better than this spot. Best guy we can get. They took a chance. It didn't work out. And because mm-hmm. of that, they didn't sign their second round pick. But as we just laid out, okay, so they get another pick next year, this one pick later. So the penalty to them is a time penalty of you won't have access to that player for this right. year. But beyond that, it's just like not really a long-term like big hit. Is there anything I'm mistaking there or, you know, that viewpoint of it? Like, how do you see it?
I think the only way something like this can be super negative for a team is if you mess up this pick with unprotected picks that don't come with beneficial picks. And I believe it's the top three round picks are all protected. So if you don't sign those round players, you get a pick next year, the spot after you're drafting. So it is set up in a way to where really for teams, it's a low risk scenario. Because like I said, you get a pick next year, there's a time penalty. Maybe you did really like the player and you really would have liked to sign him, but in terms of the value you're getting next year, you'll recoup that value. I do think there are scenarios where if you are creating overslot savings for a specific pick that you don't sign, you need to have fallback options or else you've just created more money that you don't have anywhere to spend. This is what happened with the Mets when mm-hmm. they drafted Kumar Rocker several years ago. Not only did they not sign Kumar Rocker because of the medical situation, but they created savings in the first place in order to sign him. And then they did not have fallback players later in the draft to push that savings towards. The way Cleveland operated this year is picture perfect for how you would want to do it if this wasn't going to happen, because they did have an 11th rounder, Jacob Bean, who they were able to push extra money towards. They signed him for $200,000, $50,000 over, and they spent the full 5% overage on their pool, which now comes less their second round pick value, which is 1.59. So in terms of the players they were able to sign and the money they were able to spend, they maximized what they were able to do. So I think that's the scenario from the team side where you obviously wanted the player. You would have liked to be able to sign him there because Logan Schmidt at 59, as you said, JJ, would have been a tremendous value, first round talent. For Logan Schmidt, it will be interesting to see what he decides to do moving forward. It sounds like he's still debating on whether or not he wants to honor the original commitment to LSU. That would be 3 years later for him to be draft eligible again, or go the JUCO route. I think that'll be fascinating for its own reasons. But yeah, that's kind of how I'm viewing that pick now.
there's the other point I would make with that is, like you just laid out, right? Like, yes, you are completely right. Clearly the Guardians kind of approach this, and you could say, like, either way you want to say it, they basically just took a chance on the possibility they could sign Schmidt. To what you just said, they didn't line up. They lined up money to make sure they could sign Savion Sims in the seventh round, right? Like, they sent, gave him $1 million. So they knew that they were going to have to create bonus pool, you know, amounts to sign him for a mil. They knew they needed 50K to go to Bean. However, one thing about this is they were taking a chance, but clearly they also kind of probably knew the way they structured this. There's also a pretty good chance they're not going to sign him, because they were essentially saying, your choice is you can sign with us for a slot at 59 or you can go to school. It wasn't, hey, we don't know what your number is, but we can give you slot at 59 plus X. It was slot. The minute you're doing that, you're just saying, like, hey, there's a chance. And if not, what you just said, it's on now next year's pick, if I remember my draft rules correctly, will be a unprotected pick for them. I don't think you can do it 2 years in a row. You can't push a pick twice.
Correct. Correct.
Which is not a problem, because what they will do next year, I promise you, with pick 60, is they will take someone at pick 60 who they have already agreed to a deal with, as they did. They signed every other draftee that they had this year. That's not going to be a problem. It's a minor thing, but I did want to, again, I think that there's a misconception out there. I get it. Like, if you're used to other drafts, that would seem like a giant whiff. If, like, well, the Rams failed to sign their second round pick in the NFL
draft. I do still think I don't think it's all clear for Cleveland, to be clear. Like, if they had taken a different player at that pick, you maybe wind up with a better draft. Like, it is still a bit of a loss. It's not entirely, no negatives. It's just the way the draft is set up. It is very much to protect the teams for these situations. So,
okay. So to go into a little bit more of this, we now have the draft is done, which also means the draft bonuses are all in. And I would kind of ask with that, in either way, right? Like, we're trying to as best we can, like, we're not going to say that talent lines up exactly based off of bonuses, because obviously if you were a college senior, you're not getting the same leverage. If you're a draft eligible sophomore, you can maybe make a little bit more sometimes than a junior. There's all kind of little bit of caveats to this. However, as you've noted before, as you've mentioned on the pod before, how the draft lines up bonus wise is a little bit more of a read on how the talent is lined up than where they're picked, because we saw it again this year. Like, you have, you know, there's leverage and all that, but when people say, well, Zion Rose was a shock that he went where he went, and then you look at his bonus, he got paid, but there are a number of players who went after him who got paid less. You got paid more. So what surprised you either way from the bonus pools?
There are a couple that I want to go to quickly, but I think the Zion Rose one is actually a good one to start with, because when he was selected sixth overall, we'd heard some whispers of his name. I assumed this was going to be a significant underslot deal. It was an underslot deal. It was not an underslot deal anywhere close to the degree that I expected it to be.
He was the 10th highest bonus.
Exactly. So, and for some context too here, he was paid $5.8 million. AJ Gracia, who went a couple picks later, who felt like much more of an on-the-board selection for where he was taken, he signed for just $4 million. That gap doesn't make any sense to me in terms of, like, where we viewed the talent, where we ranked the players. The deal I was expecting Kansas City to get was Zion Rose. So it's telling me two things. One, clearly the Royals really valued Zion Rose at a high level, much more than just, hey, we're trying to create savings here. They like the talent. Obviously, they're going to take the first overall pick. They're going to like the talent of whoever they take, even if it comes with some savings. But I'm very fascinated by Zion Rose now because of that money. On I wouldn't say the opposite end, but another pick that surprised me pretty significantly, and this was the quote-unquote worst value in a piece we did earlier this week looking at the best and worst values. If you layer on MLB slot values to our draft rankings, I go into the details of, like, how this works, some of the caveats, how it is a little bit crude. But Carson Wiggins, for me, the Mets first round pick at number 27 overall, when this pick happened, in real time, it was surprising to me because Carson Wiggins was not a name we had heard mentioned much at all around the first round. We ranked him just outside of the top 100 for us. And so when it happened, I was like thrown a little bit. I was like, huh, there are a lot of other college pitchers still on the board I expected to maybe go in this range. Jack Riddell, who went just after, Taylor Rabe, Tegan Coons, all those names would have made a ton of sense to me. Carson Wiggins goes in front of those players. He also signs for more than all of those players. He gets slot value at that pick with the signing contingency. That was shocking to me.
24th largest bonus in the class.
The pick was surprising, but I could rationalize it in my head in real time because the stuff is great. You're taking a big shot on the upside. I get that. I expected it to be an underslot deal. I expected it to come with a lot of savings for the Mets. So kudos to Carson Wiggins. Doesn't throw a single pitch this spring. I think he has 14 collegiate innings under his belt. To get that signing bonus is a massive win for him. And then in the opposite direction, the other big one I want to point to, and I'll maybe throw out two, just because I feel like it'll be an interesting conversation to start with you, but Sawyer Strohsnyder for $2.1 million is far and away the biggest value in terms of our board, where we rank Strohsnyder, where he actually was selected and was signed for. I mean, $2.1 million is a lot of money. Our board would have valued him at 5.6 if you were just slapping on slot values to our rankings. That's a $3.56 million difference, more than anyone else. I've talked about a lot on this podcast how I'm really excited about Sawyer Strohsnyder. Part of me is like questioning whether I should be, but I also just still buy into the athlete and the tools enough to think this is a great deal for the Brewers. And then I'll also add in here, and you can pick on whichever one of these you want to go in, JJ, or throw out any other ones that surprise you. But Jacob Lombard, I think we have to mention as well. We heard of him as a potential slider, not to the same degree as what Strohsnyder actually did. But when he went to the Marlins, I think a lot of people probably expected this to be an overslot deal, just given where he was ranked on consensus, the talent. He goes into the middle of the first round and then signs for still an underslot deal at $5 million. But that's the second biggest value for us if you're slapping slots onto rankings. So take that wherever you want to go.
I want to take that in a couple directions, including the topic we want to say, like what we've learned from this draft, trends we saw in this draft. I think this is kind of a key part of this, and we'll get to that right after this quick break.
Big second half of the season coming up. There might be a hot ticket, a rivalry series, a sold out experience that you need to get your hands on. And SeatGeek is the spot for that. You can find good pricing. They help you with the pricing. Green dot, good. Red dot, not as good. And they help you with your view of the seat for some big matchups coming up in August, September, and eventually leading up to playoffs.
Why would you not use SeatGeek? If you want to view from your seat, you want to know if it's a good seat, if it's a good deal, it has all of it on the app. It's easy to use. It's one click, boom. You buy the tickets, they send them right to you. You get them on the app, and then you can go check out whatever game, whatever you're a fan of, you can go to, whether it's baseball, whether it's concerts, whatever you're into, you can find a ticket, and you can always try to find the green dot on SeatGeek.
And for MLB tickets, you can get 10% off with that promo code we're running all season long, Territory10. That's Territory10 off your next set of MLB tickets at SeatGeek. Make sure you click the link in the description to download the app and have the code automatically added to your account so you can use it later.
So, Carlos, like, I think that this kind of dives into the biggest trend I would think that we've recognized from this draft, which you could also throw into. We always try to learn from the draft. Like, we're not going to have everything perfect. What we did right, we look at what we did right, what we did wrong. We're going to get some of the more of that. Both of those players, though, I think are tied to the component, which is, I think this is smart on teams' part. Teams, if you ask for what was a big picture flashing red signal from this, you know, siren, whatever it was.
Yeah.
If you've got a hitter, hit tools over power. If you've got a hitter and you're like, I don't know about the power, but he can really hit. That was thumbs up in this draft. The flip side, and I would say Strohsnyder and Lombard, we talked about on the podcast, like risk factors with draftees. And we talked about Lombard, how Lombard, if we basically said, like, if Lombard is going to fall in this draft, it will be because of his contact rate concerns. And you listed off a list of somewhat frightening comparisons with that.
Right. Yeah.
with Stroh Snyder. Stroh Snyder overall contact rate, his contact rate and his chase rate were the concerns really with him. And so clearly teams like it, if you say, okay, well, if you, you know, like even if you say like, okay, compare that to the other, you know, outfielders and where they went, like one of the things I would say with that is like in hindsight, like some of the players who were like, okay, we're surprised by Zion Rose, right? Now, Stroh Snyder is a tool, like tools wise is just a different type of player than Rose.
Right.
But Rose does have a better bat to ball skills than Stroh Snyder.
Right.
He goes a lot higher than him. Obviously he's not the only one, but we saw Drew Burris go quite like we saw guys who the overall thing it seems like we saw, and I want to kick it back to you, is over and over in this class, the way I would say it is when you saw guys go higher, get more money than we expected. It was almost always position player wise. It was, they love the hit tool. And if there are questions about it, it would be tools, but a lot of times it would be how much is the power there? The right. flip side of that is the guys were like, that guy's still on the board. That guy hasn't gone yet. Those were generally guys I would say who it was like, yep, that guy's still on the board. And if you say, well, why is that? The answer would be, because there's contact concerns, the hit tool might not be there. Like, I don't want to bring up a couple other examples of this. You know, we heard like
I was about to go through them if you want. Yeah.
Ty Head is one that comes to mind for me as a weird one, but like, because his performance numbers don't even match it. But like, obviously, we saw like Jake Shafter. Jake Shafter got $100,000 less than Sawyer Stroh Snyder. I don't think we'd have ever imagined that coming into the draft, but go through some of them.
No, I don't think so. Yeah. Yeah. If you look down our board, and this happened in real time on the draft, we were kind of not waiting for it, but when it was happening, it was pretty clear the profiles that were falling and the profiles that were going earlier. They had inverse skills and offensive traits that you're talking about. But Ryder Helfrich, he's in our top 10. He slips to 15. Jacob Lombard, who we mentioned, he slips to 14. Sawyer Stroh Snyder slips into the second round. Daniel Jackson, a guy who had a lot, I wouldn't say Daniel Jackson slipped, but he had some mentions of potential first round. He went around where we ranked him, which is why I hesitate to say he slipped, because I think this is more true. We maybe were more on top of his question marks and like relatively where he was going to.
Here's why he slipped. He got the 56th largest bonus.
Okay, correct. A lot of this too is that it's regular for a lot of the high schoolers to get paid more because you kind of have to pay them
right.
more.
Right, but I'm saying even among the college guys, he got less than, you know, like you would expect at that spot.
Going beyond them, Caden Sorrell was another one, 62 overall. Huge strikeout rate concerns. He slipped a lot further than we expected him to. The other one I want to mention here, and I haven't even gotten to him on the board because he fell so far, but Aiden Robbins, third round. He's the other obvious one to me that if you're looking at service level stats, even the strikeout rate for his career, it's not really too jarring. He hit for a high average. He didn't strike out a ton, but there were underlying contact questions that didn't help him model super well and led to more pure hit tool concerns and risks. So those are the ones that all stand out to me. Potentially there could be a few others we talk about, but I do think the overall trend of this year's draft is that more than any other draft we've seen, universally, teams seem to covet, prize, and value and pay hitters with contact skills. And they were scared of hit tools in a way that I don't know that we've seen to this level, because in previous years, we've had some teams like the Orioles take a shot on a Vance Honeycutt. We've had some of these polarizing profiles get selected. And maybe you could even say, oh, that still happened this year. Jacob Lombard goes in the first round. Justin LeBron doesn't fall too far. And I do think part of this is some of the hit tool risk that was taken high, they play shortstop and they play catcher. So I do wonder if there is just a bit more tolerance for teams to take those profiles if you're a shortstop or a catcher, because the difference in defensive value for those players compared to a college outfielder is fairly significant. So I think moving forward, the takeaway is, while I think we've mentioned this and been aware of it, and I think personally are quite scared because we've done the studies and the research, when we're reflecting these players on our board, we should be more skeptical of hit tools and hit concern and hit risk than we have been in the past. And even like for split decisions, like an Eric Booth and a Jacob Lombard. Part of me internally throughout the spring was like, oh, I personally like Eric Booth, but that's not enough to warrant him going higher. Well, I think in kind of deciding some of these players who are in the same tier in future years, leaning towards the player that makes more contact, I think is probably a safe takeaway from how teams operated this year.
To give you an example, I'm going to kind of spring this on you and let you kind of just, I'm looking at this. So going to our, we do the tools grades for everyone in the top 200. I just sorted it by outfielders to kind of go to your point, right? So here are the outfielders who we had with sub 50 hit tools, right?
Yeah.
Sawyer, our number one ranked one was Sawyer Strohsnyder. We just talked about that. Our number two was Caden Sorrell. You talked about him and Aiden Robbins, right? Andrew Williamson was at 48. Noah Wilson.
He goes 68.
Blake Bowen. Noah Wilson. Blake Bowen. Will Gasparino at 80. Where did Gasparino go? Like a little later than that,
I think,
right?
He went in the fifth round. Yeah, fifth round, 161.
Okay.
Blake Bowen, not drafted.
So,
okay. Noah Wilson, not drafted.
Okay. Again, obviously they're getting paid too, but okay.
Correct.
Kevin Roberts Jr., 94. I think that one actually was kind of at least in the range. Yeah. Was where the
he went in the fourth round, 110. That one makes sense.
Okay. Yeah. Another guy that we got all the questions, why did Colin Ritchie not, you know, go? Why did he not? 109 on the list. Right. You know, again, you just go down the list, like other guys who are like, okay, we had Brady Harris at 154. That guy.
Yeah, kind of expected him to get to college.
But the other 35, Caden Bogenpool, I think he actually went reasonably well, did he not?
Yeah, he went in a good spot. He was 64th overall, again, to the Phillies. So Phillies took a couple of these guys.
So, but the overarching point of this being, though, is that I would say that's the biggest trend we saw this year, is that especially when you come to bat first positions, it's like, hey.
The bar is higher.
The bar is higher. And I will go back to, I think teams are right on that. I think that this is a trend that makes sense. The problems with all of this is we talk about this over and over. The draft is a slow feedback loop, right? You draft players, then you see what they do for the next 2, 4, 6, 8 years. And then you realize what you're going wrong and what directions, right? But you're always looking backwards too. And I would say with that, that one of the things that we have absolutely found is when you take those chances on that power, a lot of times it doesn't work out, right? Like if you say, like, if you go back a few drafts, and I'll kind of, you know, like, I think this is the thing that we're going to probably spend more time kind of camped out on than anything else in this, you know, kind of as far as the topics. But I'll ask you, you've done a lot of these drafts for us now. Like, I feel like every year we get a little bit more hesitant. Like, I will tell you right now, I was more worried about Jace LaViolette last year than I would have been about that guy in 2019, right? Like, just from a here's what I think kind of way, here's my viewpoint on it, having looked at it. I even, like, when we talk about the minor league side, right? I just wrote about Nolan Schubart, who was a power dude a couple of, you know, years ago in the draft. Like, in the minors, guys who produce even gaudy, Andrew Fisher leads the minors in homers right now, and I'm still worried about him because of his contact rates, which are
borderline. It does feel like we have a better way to more granularly point to why players strike out, and it mostly just comes down to, are you capable of making contact or not? And we have a much wider data set of that for college players, for high school players even at this stage, for minor league players. We have now had a few years to see, okay, what do the players who struggle as amateurs in this department, do they improve in pro ball? And it does seem to be like largely teams are operating under the assumption that they can help improve bat speed, they can help improve strength, they can help improve approach, they can help improve angles, like batted ball angles, they can help improve a lot of that. And it does feel like contact is kind of the one area that is more innate. You either have the hand-eye coordination, you either can make contact or you can't. And it's a lot harder to build up that skill and develop it at the next level. It's almost like, hey, if you're not making contact in college against this pitching, why are we going to expect you to either maintain your current rates or improve them? It's a very hard sell. And I think the players who do make those jumps are probably extremely rare. And so teams are going towards profiles that they just feel more comfortable with, who have weaknesses that they feel like they can more easily develop at the next level. That's my large takeaway.
I just called up our 2023 draft board. The best player in the top 200 with a 40 or worse hit tool, star. He's a star. Nolan McLean. He's a star, but yeah, he also is a pitcher now.
He should have stopped hitting in college.
Yeah, he's a pitcher now.
No chance to make contact as a hitter.
But if you said, like, okay, well, who are the guys who were in the top 100 from that? Eric Batonti, Mac Horvath, Grant Gray, Maui Ahuna, George Wolko, Brandon Winokur, Cole Kerrig, Will Gasparino. Cole Kerrig, I would say, has improved that hit tool. But that I would say, as a general rule, I would say that that's a list where you're like, I don't know about those guys now. You know, like most of those guys, there's still a lot of tools there. Okay, let's flip it. You ready? Here's the 40 or sub power from that group. Number one, that list of guys with 40 or low power was Jacob Wilson. 60 hit, 40 power. We're good. Enrique Bradfield was 2, triple A, but Dylan Head, Adrian Santana, Luke Kuechel was 6th of that list. I'll go through Mike Bovee, Mitch Jebb, Roman Martin, Ryan Lasko, Trey Morgan, Alex Mooney, Homer Bush Jr., Luke Schliger, Cole Kerrig also there, Dylan Cup, and Boston Barrow in the top 100. Now, again, I'm not saying that that's Cooper Ingles on the list in the 1 to 200s. I'm not saying that everyone after that, you know, everyone who didn't have power ended up being great either. But some of those guys were like also like defense guys without a hit, like a plus hit tool too. But I would absolutely take that list right there much more than I would take the list of, in hindsight, the power guys.
Right.
Any other trends that stood out to you as from this draft, like anything on the pitching side that seemed different?
I don't think so. No, nothing jumped out to me on the pitching side. I think probably looking into that would maybe be forcing the issue a little more. I do think teams have enough differences. Teams have enough differences, I think, in what they're selecting for pitching-wise. It's kind of interesting to look at like what specific teams seem to be targeting. I didn't have a clear overriding theme for pitchers, no.
Okay. So the next question I wanted to ask, we'll start with the positives, right? We like to examine, and this is not, back padding, but we want to learn from each draft, okay? We just talked about one of the things that we got. I wouldn't say wrong, but like it's a trend that is changing and we're going to try to adapt to it. Mm-hmm. What did we get right about this draft? When you look at how the draft lined up, how it's sorted out, and I'll throw out some things too, because again, it's a little, I'm kind of asking, hey, Carlos, well, you ran our draft board. What did you do a good job
when, of? One we got right is we had Rock Chalowski and Grady Emerson 1-2 in our way too early mock. And I think, I mean, for me, and we see it with the signing bonuses, we see how the actual picks went. I feel like, and it's difficult for me here, because for me, I felt like Rock Chalowski is very clearly the top player the entire draft cycle. And I didn't feel like there was another player that was better than him. And any time that I was deciding between Rock or Grady, or like the feedback we were sorting out, it was always like Rock is the number one player. And I think there was a lot of noise that we had in the lead up to the draft, either because of prospect fatigue for Rock Chalowski, because he didn't improve significantly on his sophomore season, which was a college player of the year season. Those are exceedingly rare for sophomores. He came out and was the same player again. And so I feel like avoiding prospect fatigue with Rock Chalowski was probably an area where we did a good job this year. And again, this is not me patting my back.
No, but that's absolutely true. Like Rock Chalowski, you were saying all along, you didn't. And again, the funny thing about this is I will say also big picture on this. We were also adamant all the way around that it was not like, but this is where there's Bryce Harper at 1 and like anything, or Steven Strasburg at 1, where you're like, no one's even, anything other than you're taking him 1-1 is just window dressing to try to bring down the bonus. This was like, there was a real debate. There was a real discussion. But at the end of the day, Rock was 1. Yeah. What I would also kind of, if I look at it like bigger picture and all, like we said that we felt like that this was a draft that no one ever ascended. Like Flora was the clear SP1. And then it was like, who's going to take this SP2 crown? And the answer was no one at the end of the day. It's like, right. And we saw that in the draft, right? Like we said, this was not a draft where you're going to see a lot of pitchers go high. I will still say I'm surprised it was as much as it was, which like basically you really saw it was a very hitter heavy draft at the top.
Right.
That's something I think we kind of expected and we saw. And, you know, like at the end of the day, we also, I feel like I'll throw this out to you. We kind of said like that this felt like that it was a group that after you got, okay, we'll get to the, what we got wrong. Like, but once you got past that top tier, it was going to be very jumbled because there just wasn't a lot of separation. You know, if someone wants to say we got wrong on Zion Rose, we'll own that. Like that we did not have him rated as highly as clearly the Royals did. But well, that group is all kind of really close together.
The other thing I'll mention that I think we got right, and this maybe is just like how you should read our content in the run-up to the draft, is I do feel like a lot of the pieces, mock drafts, what we're hearing, a lot of that stuff panned out. And I think a lot of the big surprises that maybe if you weren't reading our content would have actually been surprises to you, probably wouldn't have been if you were reading all of our content. I think a lot of what we said has a chance to happen. Jacob Lombard has a chance to slip a little bit. So your Stroh Snyder has a chance to slip. We maybe got wrong the degree that Stroh Snyder would have slipped because I didn't think he was going to fall as far as he did. I think we were on that. We were on, hey, don't be surprised if Zion Rose go higher than you expect. Like we were on the Royals are interested in him. So I think like general trends, and if you're watching the draft on draft day, I think largely kind of the big picture movement we were on, even in Logan Schmidt, like being at more volatility with Logan Schmidt. That's something we wrote about. And mostly it's just like, hey, we're continuing to talk to people who are making these decisions. We're continuing to have conversations. I think where we can transition now into like some of the things we got wrong, if you want, unless you had any final comments here. But I do think one of my takeaways personally from this year that I'm going to try to be on top of more moving forward is there is still a lot of real player movement in the final month leading up to the draft, even after seasons are over, because evaluations are still happening from the team side. And for my perspective, a lot of my conversations in the run-up to the draft in that final month are very targeted to the first round, the top 40 picks, the top 50 picks. It's a lot of mock draft reporting. And I do think there are players beyond that range who are still moving their stock pretty significantly that I would like to better capture in our final rankings down the stretch. A few of those players who stand out to me, Trey Ebel, 25th to the Brewers. We heard him as a consistent riser. And some of these players are just tricky because I do think Trey Ebel was straight up a split camp player. Some teams
was just not going to go to, right?
Right. Right. Some teams had him ranked as a potential top 50 type. Clearly the Brewers had him ranked in that range. They took him 25th overall. They're trying to get a monopoly on the Ebel family. Maybe the player that this makes more sense with, because throughout the entire cycle, he was a split camp player, but Taj Marchand. Taj Marchand is interesting because we ranked him in the second to third round range and pretty consistently mocked him number 33 to the Rays because we just heard the Rays were all over him. They take him 33, but he's another one where like half the industry seemed to like him in that range. Half the industry is like, we'll take him in the third round if he gets there, but he's not going to get there. So ranking those players appropriately is always going to be a pain, regardless of like when we're updating. The other player that I think had a lot of really strong up arrow helium that I think in hindsight, I would have liked to capture more in our final rankings, but Jack Slightem, we did move him up a little bit. I think I would have even liked to move him up higher than where we did. But for me, that's a takeaway and a lesson for moving forward is when we get close to the draft, don't miss out on players in the second, third, fourth, fifth round range on our board that still warrant a lot of movement, because it's just hard to, have the volume of conversations you need to have to make sure it's all buttoned up as perfectly as you can possibly get it. And it'll never be perfect, but I want it to be closer to perfect next year than we were this year.
Along those lines, a couple of things with that. Like, as you said, like, this is hard. Like, I didn't want to ask.
Edwards would be the other obvious name. I thought Mason Edwards was going to go higher. He went 47th. We were talking about him moving up. That would be, like, a specific player, I think, that we got wrong this year.
Okay. Would the guys move up in the final month? How much of that is second looks of what they've done over the season Does the combine performance, do you think, play a role? Like, when a guy tests well? Like,
I think it's all of those. I think it's combine. I think it's interviews. I think it's teams getting the time and space away from the season to go over all their profiles and line players up, and they're just coming back to one player and they're like, hey, we really like this player with the totality of all these seasons. We still like him better. So they kind of keep getting moved up with their conversations. I think on-field at the combine is important. I think summer leagues. There are a lot of high school players that are playing in summer leagues. Elliot Lascelles, I think, is a great example of a player who performed well and just kind of gave teams more confidence. So being able to react to early Cape performance, early MLB draft league performance, other summer leagues where high school players, college players are taking part in, any sort of data that teams are able to get on pitchers, on hitters. This could be injured guys like Carson Wiggins or Logan Redman who are able to get on the mound and throw. Like, those can really move the needle. So really anything and everything that you still, and even if it's no new information, I do think there is still something to the idea of teams having meetings. And there are players who are, same with how we talk through players. And once we're able to look through everything and have a conversation about the player, we're like, hey, you know what? Like, we really don't have a lot of flaws or question marks with this player. We like him better after having the conversation. I think that element can also be helpful.
So one thing along those lines that I also think, like, is a thing I learned, you know, what we got wrong or want to adjust for next year, is I've got to change something that's been kind of my driving force of like, hey, we're going to have reports for everyone in the top 10 rounds. And as someone who then kind of wrote up the 10th round of all the guys that were missing in the 10th round, we're going to change that approach, because nothing against guys, congratulations on being drafted and signing, but like, if you flip it, right, when we say the bonuses at the top and how that shows you what teams really think about the talent, the flip side of that is that there are a whole lot of guys who got drafted in the 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th rounds who are not considered at the same level of prospect as guys who did not get drafted and signed as undrafted free agents. And so going forward, I don't think it makes sense that we're going to really work hard. Those are the guys we're missing. Like, I'm not telling you don't miss anyone in the top 10 rounds, but the guys we're missing in the top 10 rounds, the vast.
Yeah, the way I would say it, JJ, is a lot of those. So our policy currently is like anyone in the top 10 rounds is going to get a report. I think in previous eras that made a lot of sense, and we're seeing why it doesn't, because to JJ's point here, a lot of these players taken in the 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th round, they are taken specifically because they're going to take a huge underslot deal to create savings for other players. A lot of the times, those players are not legitimate prospects. They're more organizational fillers, which no shade to them getting a chance in pro ball. They'll have a chance to change that reputation. There are some guys who go on to become legitimate prospects. But basically, anyone taken in the 11 to 20 round range, I would say I'll have to run the numbers, but I would say 95% of those players are signing for $150,000 or more. And so almost as a blanket rule, you could say any of those players are more legitimate prospects than the senior signs. And so our focus and energy spent on adding reports should be towards more of the 11 to 15 bucket, probably.
I would say this, right? Again, like, if you said, what is the policy we're going to change? It's like, if it's a senior sign we do not have in the 5th round on, we're not going to write that player up at that moment. We'll let it be, because I will tell you right now, again, I'm not trying to pick on any players, but I wrote up players where I'm like, this player does not feel like a draft prospect, right?
Right.
Like, I wrote up first basemen without power who don't hit for average. I wrote up pitchers who don't have a standout pitch who are poor performers, like things like that. And it's like, if we said that our new rule, like, we really probably should say that we were going to, if we have anyone in the 11th and 12th round that we're missing, we're going to, that's where our first emphasis, anyone fifth and round or higher and 11th round on, because 11th year, and 12th rounds, they sign.
Every year, teams like the Brewers too are the best at this so far. I'm sure there are going to be more teams that do well here, but there are always these hideout high school players in that range who are signable, and maybe not every team knew they were signable, maybe not every team scouted them, but those players are just more interesting, more exciting, more toolsy, more upside almost across the board than a lot of the senior signs. And I also think, just from a value add perspective, for most of the senior signs, if fans of teams really want to know about those senior signs, there's a lot of data and surface level information that you can get on those players yourself. I do think creating some more context on who are these high school players in the 11 to 15 range, it will probably be more meaningful for BA readers. And that's an area I would like to get more aggressive on too.
I'm looking at it. And right now, as we're doing this, I see a couple of guys that are probably worth us still going back and writing a report on. Cause it's like, there's Bane Barker, the Marlins 12th rounder, got 497,500. Sandalwood High right-hander out of Florida.
It almost should be like, it would be nice to have this prior to the signing deadline so we could already get start working on it, but almost like, hey, anyone who signs for X amount of money is worth writing up. So
Carson Hart, 380K outfitter from Mankato East in Minnesota with the Brewers. Like, those are guys where it's like, to what you just said, it's way more valuable to have a report on those guys. There's something that was seen there where it's like, that guy may be something. Again, I wish best of luck to the guys who signed for 500,000, 1500, but those are not the guys that teams are like, we really believe that guy, like, to be honest, again, we saw undrafted free agent signing for 200K, right? Like,
so I just looked at some numbers really quickly. There are 288 players who signed for at least $200,000, including the signing bonus contingency. So for us, that means like anyone who shows up for $2,500 under that number on the draft database. A vast majority of those players will already have reports for it. But I do think if you're expanding that out, you're getting into a couple 11th rounders, 10th rounders, like that. That being the benchmark to hit, and then I guess we could see how.
So what's the number you said? Like, if we did that, that would be 200K basically.
200K seems like a sensible number to start at, yeah. And then if we could get closer to anyone for more than 150, that would make sense too. But which I do say, think, yeah, figuring out a better way to do that.
I'm counting. There's 15 players. There's only 15 players that fit the criteria that we don't have reports on right now. So the good news
we could expand it a little more then, maybe.
But the good news is the vast majority of those players, which is what you would expect, right? That's what,
right?
At the end of the day, just be honest about it. We're not going, oh no, we didn't have a pre-draft report on the guy who signed for $500. That's not a.
Do you know how many players we had reports on who signed for at least 150,000? Because that's the number. Anything over that, like that 150 to 200 range, essentially. I don't know if. There's probably a lot more 150 that we don't have. But
if you say over 150, then we're at 23 more. So that will be 38 players.
I think while hesitating to implement some editorial policies live on the podcast, it does feel like 150 or more next year would be something to make.
That makes a whole lot of sense. And even if we say like, hey, you know, that means that some of them, there'll be a couple guys who we're going to sign, we're going to write up right after the deadline. That's fine. But we also are going to say with that, we're not going to write up a senior that we know he's a senior and was drafted in the 9th round. We're not writing that guy up unless they sign for more money. Because
And we'll hope to have a lot of those guys picked off on our senior list, because that is still a real strategy teams use. And if we can say, hey, here are the priority guys, here are the most interesting college seniors, like being able to create value with an interesting player there is still a legitimate part of the process. But I'm sure getting into the weeds here is probably maybe straining
probably
the
perfect place for us to end this rather than
this is a fun
hold a draft meeting on the podcast. But again, I hope that people do understand, and I hope you appreciate that we do care about this, and that's why we're like
very really much so.
Again, we put a lot of time. There are bags under our eyes, and we are not complaining because this is fun and great to do. But there is a lot of work we put into making sure that we are trying to cover the totality of the draft, not stop when you just pick 50 or pick 100 or pick 150 even. Like, the whole draft does matter. And that's where I would say that, like, you know, it's funny, but we're sitting here and I'm scanning through, and it's like, if you look at past year's drafts, and it's like, yeah, if you look at most of the guys that you look at in that 11th, 12th, 13th, 15th round money, round who get more money than slot allows. Yeah, a lot of these guys, you're like, oh, I don't know whatever happened to Adler Cecil, the left-hander from Temecula that the Padres took in the 19th round in 2023. You know, but there's also, you go through this and you're like, oh, but I know what happened to Riku Nishida who was the 11th rounder for, you know, for the Sox in 2023, who got more than slot and made the majors this year, or Andrew Sears, or Matthew Edsel, or, you know, like you can just keep going down this list. And there are these guys where it's like, yep, that's, you know, again, as we just said, the bonuses, it's not everything because there's leverage, but the bonus amounts do tell you a lot. And by the way, I will say, like, you also saw, you see undrafted free agents who are signed out of high school still every now and then too, which is interesting. But okay, that is our Baseball America Draft Podcast for today. We got a little bit in the weeds there at the end. Hope you don't mind. but do check out baseballamerica.com. Carlos has all kind of stuff that wrapped up the signing deadline. And in addition to that, like if you're interested in other baseball things like the trade deadline, or we have a top 100 update coming next week and top 30 updates coming after that.
Oh, we got a good sale that doesn't always happen on the website for the trade deadline as well, to point
a trade deadline sale as well. Check that out, Baseball America. If you're not a subscriber already, there's a way to get in and get in for a little bit less money than normal. So for Carlos, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.